Six cases on today's argument calendar, and we will begin in appeals number 23-2714 and 24-1029, Signal Funding versus Sugar, Felsenthal, and others. Sir, is it Gekas? Gekas, good morning. Nice to see you.
Good morning. Again, I am Chris Gekas. May it please the court. I don't really have much to add unless the court has questions to our briefs. I think the necessary beginning has to do with the question of jurisdiction, because there are two appeals here. Without getting into the details, we think that as we argue in our jurisdictional statement, we think that the 23 is moot. It was
I'm sorry, you bleeped out there for a minute. What you think? What is mooted?
We think that the 23 numbered case, 2714, is it, is mooted by the second appeal, which is from the final judgment. In the first appeal, Judge Lefko certified an interlocutory order and left pending against the original defendant in the case claims that were then delayed for trial. We filed a lengthy jurisdictional statement in the 23 case, and then the case below proceeded to final judgment, so we lodged another appeal, and this court consolidated them. And all the issues that were present in the interlocutory appeal are even more perfected in the second appeal. So we don't think that your honors have to.
They're not all folded together.
I'm sorry?
They're not all folded together.
They are. We think that the issues are amplified, at least a factual matter and legal questions, by the resolution. There's a series of questions that we didn't really deal with in the jurisdictional statement that has to do with the fact that no final judgment was entered as the interlocutory rule. So one of the questions is, what's the record are you looking at? The certification came several months after the ruling that was being certified. So what is the record? Is it the record as of the original order that's being appealed from? Is it the record from the date of the certification? What's the implication of the fact that the district court did not enter a final judgment? All of those things now go away, we think.
So the Rule 54B ruling would capture everything, is your opinion?
Well, I guess the answer is sort of. We really haven't, because we believe the case is moot, we really haven't delved into the question of what is the distinction between the two appeals. We think that everything is subsumed in the appeal from the final judgment. That's what we think. There are a series of procedural irregularities and other confused circumstances that would make the jurisdictional issue in the first case more difficult.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Mr. Gekas. Are you raising this because you think it makes a difference?
Well, I raise it
because
because of the fear that any litigator has about taking some kind of a step in a case that has unforeseen circumstances or an unforeseen result. Once you lodge an interlocutory appeal, if you don't lodge an appeal from the final judgment, you're out of luck. There's a series of rules that seems to turn everything about review on its head.
Yeah.
And so we think,
I appreciate you raising this question.
Essentially because of my view that the court typically starts with the jurisdictional problem.
Yeah, no, that's fair, and we appreciate it. I mean, we are a court of limited jurisdiction. I'll tell you, and you can push back on this, I might be mistaken. I thought that you have the 54B partial summary judgment. That's as clear as day. And then what happens is the 24-1029 is the order that kind of wraps everything else up that was lingering. My words, not anybody else's words. And therefore, there's complete closure between the two docket numbers vis-a-vis the district court, and it just all comes to us, you know, as a complete package, if you will. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
But I don't want to. If you think no, that's mistaken, and that view would have an adverse consequence, you know, for my client, that would be very helpful to hear.
No, our view about it is, if the opinion in this case comes out captioned with both numbers, without a concern about the difference between the jurisdictional power of the court, that would be fine with us. I raise this because of my review of some of the law, which I can't cite to Your Honor today because it's irrelevant to the argument, about the court being very, very concerned about appellate jurisdiction, and when there are two numbers, I think there's a series of decisions that grapple with that. I didn't want to let it go unanswered because jurisdictional is the first thing that we have to deal with.
I think those cases are factually distinguishable where there are two appeal numbers. So.
Say again, Your Honor.
I think the cases that you might be referring to are factually distinguishable,
well,
given the Rule 54B ruling here in the final judgment.
Yeah, I'm sure that's correct. I'll say it a little bit different way. I think that they can be distinguished factually, and what we have always been concerned about is to make sure that we didn't trip over some distinction between the cases that didn't occur to us that would cause, you know, we could have dismissed the first appeal. That would have been one thing we did for lack of jurisdiction. And we're not going to do that. A lawyer who does that without hearing from the court about jurisdiction, it's a dangerous thing to do because you'd be very concerned about the effect of it on the final appeal.
Okay, why don't you proceed to the merits? We'll sort out the appellate jurisdiction issue.
All right. On the merits, we really don't have much to say in addition to our brief. I think there are sort of two main substantive issues that have to do with the question of the dismissal of the appeal of the Second Amendment complaint, which appears entirely in our separate appendix, and the dismissal of the fraud and fraudulent concealment cases. And we think that the defect in what the district court did is very close to the defect in what the district court did in granting summary judgment on the question of damages in the malpractice claim that remained against the lawyers, the law firm defendants. That's what is up here before Your
Honor. Mr. Geekus, can I clarify one of your arguments? Is it, because it's not clear to me from the briefing, is it your position that even if there was no adverse relationship between your client and Ms. Jaffrey, that Sugar still had to disclose any representations of her?
Well, I guess the answer to that is probably not, because it's unequivocally we don't have to get to that point.
That's not the question. I'm just trying to clarify, if it's your position that Sugar needed to disclose to you non-adverse representations of Ms. Jaffrey.
Well, I think the answer to that is complicated by our view that there's no question that there's adversity. If, for example, Sugar,
let's assume there are representations that are not adverse.
Yeah. Like a DUI case.
Whatever it might be.
Okay.
Assume there are representations that are not adverse to your client. Is it your position that Sugar had to disclose those to your client?
Well, I think, Your Honor, to the extent that there was some kind of effect of the non-adverse discrimination on...
Discrimination?
The non-adverse representation. If there was some effect on the representation, the answer to that is yes. But let's take the hypothetical that I just raised.
How ethically, if it's non-adverse, under Illinois ethics rules, how could they have to disclose that? In fact, wouldn't it be a violation to Ms. Jaffrey if they did disclose it?
Well, the contract between the parties and the rules require the disclosure of a conflict.
Rules require a disclosure of adverse representation, not a conflict, and it even says that you can be economic competitors. What the rules of ethics require would be a disclosure of any adverse representation.
The hypothetical that you frame is one that is without a factual context. And the answer to that is that generalized hypothetical is we do not claim the requirement to disclose non-adverse representation. A hypothetical that I just raised would be a DUI. If they're representing her on a DUI, do they have to disclose this to us? The answer is if it has no...
I'm not debating what might or might not be adverse. So you're throwing in facts, trying to say what is or isn't adverse. If it's not adverse to your client, your brief suggested to me that you thought it nonetheless needed to be disclosed. And I don't know how you can argue that under the ethics rules and the law.
I don't think that is our position. The reason.
Okay, good. That's what I'm trying to clarify. Okay. So
sorry to be evasive. I don't mean to be evasive, but
I want to make sure I understand your position. So you agree that if Sugar represented Ms. Jaffrey in a matter that was non-adverse to your client, that Sugar did not have a duty to disclose it?
As a generalized theoretical matter, yes. I add on some conditions to that. If the non-adverse representation had some spillover collateral effect, it's all fact content.
What does that come from, spillover collateral?
Well, I mean...
How do you get that out of the rule, which is pretty straightforward? They have to be directly adverse.
Okay, well, you know, conflict and adversity are all fact-specific. And the rule is stated, however, in general terms. There's no question about it. When you ask me that question in a non-specific matter, the way that you phrased it, in the terms of the rule, our position is not that they have to disclose a non-adverse representation.
So wait, that was a... double negative in there.
Well,
you agree if they are not directly adverse that there is no duty on Sugar's part to disclose the representation of Ms.
Jaffrey. Also a double negative, and I do agree.
Okay.
Okay.
Can I, Mr. Geekus, can I focus you on the fraudulent concealment claim?
Sure.
Okay. The district court, in dismissing that, did allow Signal to go forward on the affirmative fraudulent misrepresentation theory. What I'm trying to figure out is what's the content of the fraudulent concealment claim that you have been unable to litigate as a result of the district court's dismissal?
Well, we haven't been able to litigate the question of the fact that these folks falsely stated there was no adverse representation. Falsely stated they did not represent.
Well, hold on. That's exactly what I thought you would say.
Right.
But when the district court said you, Signal, are allowed to go forward on a fraudulent misrepresentation, on the fraudulent misrepresentation dimension of this, aren't they allowed to go forward on what you just said?
I don't think so, Judge. The way that we read it, it was basically cutting it off at the pass entirely. We don't read it that way at all. We thought it was termination of that part of the claim that had to do with really two aspects. One of them has to do with the affirmative misstatements. We don't represent her on anything adverse. And the material omissions, so the failure to say, oh, by the way, we are organizing our company.
Did you litigate fraudulent misrepresentation claims in the district court?
After dismissal, no. It was over. That's our view. We thought it was over.
That's what the summary judgment is about, the fraudulent misrepresentation claims.
No. The summary judgment... What happened here was that she dismissed the fraud and fraudulent conveyance. She dismissed it, and we think that ended it.
Fraudulent concealment, yeah. Not the fraud. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think that's right.
Well, hold on. All right.
So
I mean, I'm looking right at her opinion.
Say again?
I'm looking right at her opinion.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, and I'll take a look at it, but our opinion was that our view was that she terminated everything in terms of fraud.
All right.
I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, very well.
Thank you.
I want to ask you one more question to, sure. on the factual side. Okay. You can, it's this. What, in your view, does the record show regarding the very first date of contact between Ms. Joffrey and Sugar?
Well, it's complicated because she was an officer of my client, both of my clients, and she was dealing with Sugar on matters related to my client's business.
Okay, contact vis-a-vis the new enterprise.
Well, I think it was.
Is it before or after September 28th, 2017, when she left?
It was the morning after.
The 29th.
Right, the morning after. What happened was is that she resigned abruptly on the evening of the 28th. And then the next morning, billing records show, and this is cited in our brief, billing records show that she had a one-hour call with all four of the individual defendants where they discussed this pre-settlement funding and the like. There's a brief billing entry that's in the record. And we think that I'll say it this way. We don't have any evidence that the contact about her new business was before that date.
Okay, that's what I was looking to clarify.
We don't have any evidence. So that's the first affirmative proof we have about it.
Thank you. Okay, let's hear from Sugar's counsel.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Amir Thomasby. Justices, I represent Sugar Felsenthal. And I'd like to start to address the fraud issue. You're correct, Justices. The fraud claim did go forward, and it went forward from October 20th, 2017. October 20th, 2017 is the date where Mr. Friedland from Sugar Felsenthal wrote an email saying, "We don't represent Ms. Joffrey in anything adverse." And what Judge Levko said is from the October 20th, 2017 date, if there were bills that were paid, if there was work that was done, then you can proceed. And ultimately, the evidence bore out that there was no work done for Signal after that October 20th, 2017 date. And there were no bills. They didn't bill Signal for any work done, including the transition work that they did.
And that's what her motion to dismiss ruling said, that the motion to dismiss is granted as to fraudulent concealment and denied as to fraudulent misrepresentation.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, what you're doing is you're without quoting from it, you're reading from pages 13 and 14 of the district court's order, or at the appendix 15 and 16.
Yeah, I am, Justice. I just wanted to clarify.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any question she allowed a fraudulent misrepresentation claim to go forward. And then what then happened in the litigation on that claim?
On that claim is it bore out that there was no work done afterwards. The testimony from Mr.
After the 20th?
After the 20th. The testimony from both Mr. Garris, who is the general counsel for Signal, and all of the Sugar Felsenthal people, the bills were produced, and it showed that there was nothing done after that date. There were no further representations. In fact, after that date, on October 27th of 2017, Mr. Friedland goes back to Mr. Garris and says, "You know what? We spoke with Ms. Joffrey. We do represent her on certain matters, and we don't think there's a conflict." And it goes back to what Justice St. Eve pointed out initially under Rule 1.7. It's specifically bore out in Comment 6. If you represent people that are economically adverse, that doesn't create a duty to disclose the details of that representation. So that's once that evidence, Justice, went through, then ultimately in summary judgment, Judge Levko said there's not enough evidence to support the fraud claim. Yeah.
And did Sugar ever affirmatively say we do not represent her in any non-adverse matters? I thought what Sugar represented was we don't represent her in any adverse matters, and we can't comment on anything else.
That's exactly what the email says from Mr. Friedland, Justice.
And was there any evidence that at any point after that email or before that they said we don't represent her in any non-adverse?
No, nothing like that.
Do you have some affirmative points you want to make?
No, but go ahead.
All right, I just want to get the benefit of your. You know the litigation very well, as Mr. Gekas does too. That, and it's this. Mr. Friedland had a deposition, right? Jonathan Friedland was deposed?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm asking a question about this narrative on this motion to compel. Okay. My takeaway from the record is that he didn't really recall many things that were pertinent to the issues being litigated. Is that fair?
I don't think that's completely fair. I think he did recall issues with the conflict and what he did with the conflict. I think it is correct that there were some timeline issues, Justice, that he did not recall the specific timeline of things.
Okay. And is it all, it is clear from the record, is it not, that he in fact at some point read that narrative?
I agree. He indicated that he reviewed the narrative.
Okay. But is it fair to take away from the overall record on this that his having read that narrative, whenever he read it, did not refresh his recollection on the kind of non-conflict matters that you were just referring to?
That's exactly right. And he said, I went through this, and nowhere did he say I used it to refresh my recollection. He says it was something I created after he received, I hope that answers your question directly, Justice. You're right. He did not say this refreshed my recollection on X, Y, and Z. That was not his testimony. And that
was the inference that, just reading between the lines of all this, if had it refreshed his recollection, then he would have been able to answer questions about these non-conflict matters.
That's exactly
whatever the answers would have been.
Logically, that would, you would think, if he looked at this memorandum and said, "Oh, okay,
so
now
the point of the question is, I don't really think this is a case where we have to figure out this business about, you know, how the rule with 612, how it overlaps or how it intersects with attorney-client privilege or work product, or anything, because I don't even think the triggering predicate of 612 is met.
I agree, Justice, and I that was going to be the point you're making was going to be the first point I was going to make. I was prepared to have the discussion about how 612 and the attorney-client privilege and work product, that's a whole nother animal, because the facts here, I couldn't agree more, don't get us to that kind of second discussion.
And there's not a lot done to my eye in the deposition of Mr. Friedland to establish, you know, the predicates of 612, to ask him very direct questions about whether this helped him refresh his recollection on these matters that are disputed and are pertinent and all that. So there's some reading between the lines that needs to happen. But it's not the best record for the proposition that there's a compelled disclosure here.
I agree. I mean, there were certain pointed questions I think that needed to be asked. I'm not being critical of anybody. In order to trigger 612, they weren't asked in the deposition, so I think it ends there. And the other point I guess I would make about that is there was also no showing in the record or in their briefs that this memorandum would have somehow affected the outcome. I think the record's devoid of that as well, which doesn't relate to kind of the 612 question directly, but just more from an abuse of discretion standpoint, would this disclosure, and how would this disclosure change the ultimate outcome?
Was there ever a request for the judge to review that document in camera? I know that's an issue on appeal, but I couldn't tell if there was ever a specific request to review it in camera as opposed to just expecting a sua sponte review.
I don't believe there was, but I'm not for sure on that, Justice. I know I never offered to for them to review it in camera, which sometimes...
But the 612 burden isn't yours.
That's right. So a couple affirmative points that I'd like to make, I'll be brief, but I want to kind of start from the end, damages and proximate cause. The entire case, Justices, is based on this $470,000 that they say Signal would have got but for some conduct of Sugar Felsenthal. And what Judge Levko did and what the evidence ultimately...
Is that the sum total of the Eager and Shaw investments?
That's exactly right.
And legal fees?
And fees. No, the fees are a little bit above the $470,000.
Okay.
Yeah. But the crux of it is if the 470 isn't, if they can't show that 470 would have went in and created damages, then the legal fees, are not, I don't think, relevant to the damages, because at that point, the legal fees had nothing to do with what Sugar Felsenthal ultimately did. And that's the point. The three points on the proximate cause and damages, Would OTRA, the question is, would OTRA, Matt Eager, and Mr. Shaw have invested but for what Sugar Felsenthal did? And if you look at the record, Justices, the testimony number one, I guess point one would be Eager and Shaw both said, I don't know what we would have done. It's pure speculation as to whether or not we would have ultimately invested in Signal at that point in time. So their testimony is clear on that. I mean, Mr. Eager is a small investment, equity investment fund. He has high interest rates, is in the record. At the time, Signal had one funding, and that was their own business, 777. And so to me, it didn't appear that OTRA and Shaw, I can point out briefly, I mean, he's an individual investor. Nobody knew who he was, Justices, and he didn't know who Signal was, and he said, I had no idea even what, you know, pre-funding settlement litigation was. He said, I invested in Ms. Joffrey. I respected Ms.
Joffrey. When you're referring to testimony, it's these here affidavits you're talking about.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
It didn't seem that the district court considered the expert testimony of David Howe, who I think was their CEO, about the impact on the loss of investments here. Is that fair, and why wouldn't that impact things?
Yes, that is fair. The district court did not consider it, and here's why it wouldn't impact it. Because his analysis was purely on, assume we got the $470,000. His analysis didn't have to do with any, his opinion didn't have to do with whether or not they would have or should have received it, but for Sugar Felsenthal. So once you have that line drawn, that there was nothing Sugar Felsenthal did to create them losing that investment, then what Mr. Huff says about the complete damages, Your Honor, I don't think is relevant to anything, because the case would be is over right there. And I would take it a step further, and my kind of, I guess I'm jumping around a little bit, so I apologize to that, Justice. But as far as Mr. Huff's opinion goes, another, I think if you were to consider it, another hole in that is that they haven't shown they needed the $470,000. So what Mr. Huff said is, if we had an extra $470,000, we would have been able to get this profit. However, and this is maybe me thinking a little bit outside the box, had they have to show they needed it. They had funding from 777. So in other words, they would have to show they missed out on giving funding loans, pre-funding loans, because they didn't have this money. And nowhere in Mr. Huff's opinion does he say, client X, Y, and Z came to us asking for a pre-litigation loan, and we couldn't give it to him because we didn't have the financing. And there's no testimony in the record that had we received the financing from specifically OTRA and Mr. Shaw, we would have been able to fund additional loans. He just says, take a $470,000 we have or can use, and then extrapolates that out into the lost profits. And that's I don't want to call it an ancillary argument, Justices, but I think it's, if you were to consider Mr. Huff's opinion, that would be something you could consider. A couple final points. It goes both ways. There's no evidence Signal would have accepted an investment from OTRA or Shaw. I mean, they flat out said, Mr. Arcenigas, who's one of their financial guys, said, I don't know what would have ultimately happened had we engaged OTRA or Mr. Shaw. And the point that I would make on that is, it's not a case where Signal was talking with OTRA and Shaw. Ms. Joffrey comes along, starts these companies, and all of a sudden now there's a jousting. Who's going to get these investors? And that goes kind of to the INDEC Podesta case, where the court said in the First District, Justice, that, so you start a new company, you got funding. Who's to say these guys didn't, the plaintiff didn't try to get that funding? So how are we supposed to make that proximate cause jump? And that's the problem in this case, Justice, is that they can't make that proximate cause to damages leap. So the own testimony, and also Mr. Alfala, and I think this is somewhat compelling, even up through, they say, we were looking for outside investors. But even up through 2021, when he was deposed, he tells me, we still don't have any outside investors. It's still 777. So I look at that and I say, how can you then say that they would have get one after OTRA and Shaw at that point? And to take it even a step further, looking specifically at the record, Justices, you remember Ms. Joffrey, when she received the general email, if there's any argument, well, maybe they got an inquiry from OTRA. So why wouldn't that be evidence that, in fact, OTRA was interested in Signal? That email was sent on to a gentleman named, I think, Jason or Josh Wander. But in any event, the owner of 777, who had direct involvement with Signal, and he ignored it. There was no pursuit of OTRA and Mr. Eager. So again, that is, I think, pretty clear evidence that no reasonable jury could find that whatever Sugar Felsenthal did was the proximate cause of damage. And then, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to quote the district court opinion, but to take it one step further, okay, say they, and we don't think they were, but say Sugar did something wrong in creating these companies, and maybe telling Ms. Joffrey you're not going to get sued, and she relays that to Mr. Eager. That would be nothing more than creating a condition, a negligence in the condition, and that goes to the Abrams case and also the Garrist v. Booth case, where creating a condition where there may be some ultimate damage is not and cannot be the proximate cause. And I think just as the Abrams case is a great example. It's a sad case because it, you know, ultimately resulted in a death, but where the city of Chicago didn't answer, didn't bring an ambulance, and then ultimately the family had to drive their child to the hospital, and they end up getting hit by a drunk driver. And so the input of that case was, well, like, look, the city probably should have had somebody out there. Ultimately, it didn't make a difference. One final point on punitive damages. We see this argument a lot where they try to say that the fraud, you know, is completely separate. Here, this revolves around this conflict, disclosures. These are all legal services, justices. These are all in the context of that. So the cases where they've allowed punitives on fraud, it's the Cripe v. Leiter case where a lawyer flat out lied about billing. And then there's other cases where there was, you know, improper relationships with the client. Those are the type of cases where they say punitive damages are available. So I think for all those reasons and the reasons that you have pointed out to the judgment of the district court should be affirmed.
One last question for you, please. Do you have any concerns about jurisdiction?
I do not. I think, Justice, you put it perfectly, that I think everything's been wrapped up into this case.
Yeah, and I think you all both agree. Tell me. I think Mr. Gikas was clear on this. There's nothing left in the district court whatsoever.
That's right.
Right, and everything is subsumed either within the 54B partial judgment or the, I don't remember the number, 1017, is it?
Yeah, I think it's 1017.
Yeah, or 27.
27.
Yeah, but between these two docket numbers, everything is subsumed and everything in the appeal falls under the umbrella of both of those docket numbers.
I agree, Justice.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas B., thanks to you.
Thank you.
To deal with the question that you asked about the effect of the dismissal, if you look at page 14 of Judge Lefkoe's decision, you'll see that she said the only thing left for fraudulent concealment has to do with attorney's fees that were paid after the date of October 20th, of which there was none. So she allowed us to make a claim for which there were no supporting facts, and that basically terminated the fraudulent concealment claim, or misrepresentation, whichever it was. On the question that you asked Judge St. Eve about in-camera submission, if you look at the appendix on page 26 attached to the main brief, there's a footnote in the magistrate judge's order that says plaintiff also asked that a copy of the document be submitted to the court for an in-camera review, et cetera, to preserve the issue for the eventuality of an appeal. The court declines the plaintiff's invitation, however, because the application of the relevant factors does not depend on the content of the document at issue, and nor is an in-camera review necessary to preserve the appellate issue. And we believe that that is absolutely mistaken, that if you had the material for the narrative here, you'd be able to tell, I think, in comparison to the testimony as to whether or not it refreshed recollection, which now goes to the point that Your Honor just made about no evidence in the record that Mr. Friedland never said, was never questioned about did it refresh recollection. And indeed, there is some support in the law, and we cite one of the cases against us, actually, in which it said if you don't ask if you did it refresh the recollection, you're out of luck. We think that's the wrong rule. The fact of the matter is that what happened here is this fellow read this narrative in preparation for the deposition, and that should be enough, at least for an in-camera submission of it, to make a determination. Because after all, the 612
make a determination as to what?
I'm sorry?
Make a determination as to what?
As to whether or not it in fact refreshed the guy's recollection. And just if I could go on and say, they're no longer, as we understood in the lower court, asserting an attorney-client privilege protection of the rule. They're only asserting work product, and work product can be pierced on a showing of prejudice. Indeed, their brief says that we didn't show prejudice, which is completely wrong. If you look at our reply brief, we have a page and a half of footnotes that show the number of times that the respondent lawyers in this case said, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall. It's at least 75 separate times. That has been deemed a sufficient justification, and we cite the cases in our reply brief. That has been deemed a sufficient justification to require the production of a document over which work product is claimed. They also say that this is a fishing expedition for counsel's files and records. And a lot of the law about the production of these things has to do with the dislike of fishing expedition. This is not a fishing expedition for counsel's record. This is a document that was written by the fella at the time. This is his own statement. So we're not looking for anything from the lawyers. We're looking for his own statement. And Rule 612 talks about the interest of justice. In the interest of justice, given the fact of the complexity of, and the distance of time between the original events and the repeated assertions by the individual lawyers that they had no recall, it seems to us that there's a very compelling interest of justice argument for the production. And we think the suggestion that you have to show that the witness has to say it didn't refresh my recollection. You know, a witness who says that, there's no ability to cross-examine or to test that assertion. And it seems to us that that is not in the interest of justice. I hope you understand my last point.
Yeah, I do. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Kikas, thanks to you. We'll take the appeal under advisement. Appreciate the work of both counsel. We'll proceed to our second.